Good evening, everybody. My name is Doug Mefford. I am an alcoholic. Thanks to the grace of loving God, the 12 steps as expressed in our book, Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found it necessary nor had the occasion to take a drink of beverage alcohol since August 15th of 1994, and I'm extremely thankful for that period of sobriety. And I'm really glad to be with you this evening. I'll just get out of the way. I'm celebrating my 52nd Earth birthday today, so I'm celebrating it with you. I honestly can't think of a better way to spend my birthday than with a bunch of alcoholics. Because without y'all, I don't know that I would have a 52nd birthday, and that's a literal truth in my life. I understand there's also a young lady named Kelly in the audience who is having a birthday today too, and her friends caught me in the hallway and asked me to mention that to embarrass her. She's over here somewhere. So, Kelly, happy birthday. It's wonderful to share a birthday with you. I want to thank Fran and the committee for doing all the work that they've done to put this together. I know I'm a substitute. I wasn't the first choice, and that's the best place for me to be. Keeps me in check. I am alcoholic. I can have ego problems if I'm not, kept in check. And, if you don't like to talk tonight, quite frankly, you can thank this young man here because he's the one that threw my name into the ring. And you can wear them out all weekend. I don't do this a ton, but when I do, I come and stay for the whole weekend and participate and engage. Unfortunately, as a last-minute substitute, I have to depart tomorrow. I have a commitment with my 19-year-old daughter and her college marching band, so I'll be departing tomorrow afternoon. I apologize for that. It's not in my nature to leave early, but prior commitments, I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, you do the first commitment. I didn't have a commitment tonight, but I do tomorrow. So I'll be departing tomorrow, but I want to thank you for letting me be here. And I want to thank the rest of the speakers for being of service and taking their time, traveling and coming to be here and share the message of recovery with us all. So I think those are all the kind of things to do and so on to get started. And I guess I'll start at the beginning. I was born at a very early age. I'm the youngest of four. I've got a really great family, quite frankly. My dad went to work, my mom stayed home, and the four of us siblings had a lot of love and a lot of camaraderie and sibling rivalry and all of those things. And really, I didn't want for anything. I didn't need anything, and I didn't want for much. My older siblings would tell you that I was a spoiled youngest child. I would tell you they didn't understand I was special. We would come to find out just how special I was, and you'll hear about that in a little while. I was well-adjusted. I had a really good early life. I was really comfortable in all aspects of my life, all the way up until they sent me off to kindergarten. And for some reason, I got around y'all, and I didn't feel like I fit in. I didn't feel like I belonged. And I don't know why that is, and quite frankly, I've stopped trying to figure that out. I just know that I, at an early age, started trying to be what it is that I thought that you thought that I should be in order to connect with you. And if you're nodding your head or understand what I just said, you're in the right place. No doubt about it. Because I don't know any other mind readers on the planet that are better mind readers than alcoholics. I live my life judging you before you spoke a word to me, just based on how you looked. So I knew you were judging me as well, and I figured I'd get the jump on you. And, if I could hate you first, then I'm safe, right? That's kind of the way that I operated in many respects. I had my first taste of alcohol when I was four. I beat my dad into submission. I didn't become a daily drunk at four. Don't worry about that. Wasn't an early budding alcoholic. I just beat my dad into submission while he's watching football with some friends. And he let me have a sip of that beer, and I loved it. And it was Pabst Blue Ribbon beer, so that gives you an idea of, maybe I got problems. But nonetheless, I know today that I wanted to be somebody else doing something else with someone else early in my life. And I wanted to be one of the men. I didn't want to be the crumb-snatching kid. I wanted to be one of the guys watching football. Now, there wasn't a lot of drinking in my home. That event was three full-grown men and a six-pack of beer. Three men, six beers. Why bother? That don't make no sense to me. I just don't get it. Never translated, but that's the way it was. Maybe some wine around dinner, things like that. But I did grow up in a home that was affected by alcoholism. My grandfather never admitted or tried to attain sobriety, but drank alcoholically. He walked and quacked like a duck. My uncles on my mother's side of the same nature, many respects. So there was a lot of untreated Al-Anonism that was in my home, control, direction, constraints. And we lived in that, and it wasn't terrible by any stretch. I benefited in many respects by those confines and those structures and that control that my mom gave, because I was rambunctious. You know, before I ever took a drink, my mom used to say to me, you know, if you were my first child, you'd be an only, you know, because that's kind of how I operated, pre-alcohol, you know, and I was wired in such a way that I had to do things that I wasn't supposed to simply because I wasn't supposed to. For instance, I was an altar boy in the Catholic Church, and they said, stay out of the wine. Well, now I got to have a pre-mass drink. You know, I mean, it makes sense to me, you know, and that's what we did. Why? Because we weren't supposed to. And if I could get away with it, it really didn't happen other than in my memory, you know. And that's the beauty of it. I just constructed my life the way that I wanted to and played make-believe quite a bit. My first drink of consequence, I was 12 years old. It was a planned event. My older brother was having a party. And we secured some booze, and I drank about 8 beers, and I got sick from my toes all the way out by the end of that night, and it was the most magical night of my entire life. I didn't care that I got sick. I was, you know, I was around older women, and I was pursuing them, you know, and I wasn't shy about that. Unfortunately, they didn't respond the way that I would have liked them to, but regardless, it was like the magic elixir, and it made me feel comfortable. I know now I ran around from an early age with my kind of shoulders rung up around my ears, afraid. Afraid of what you thought. Afraid I wouldn't fit in. Afraid I couldn't connect because I didn't know how to. And that alcohol just allowed me to let my shoulders down, take a deep breath all the way in. Prior to that, I've been breathing about to here, just kind of short and shallow breaths. But when I had that booze, the effect, the doctor's opinion describes, the sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a few drinks. When I got that ease and comfort, it was like I could take a big, deep, full breath. My mouth's watering right now. I don't know if anybody else is, but man, I can still feel what that felt like. And I don't ever want to forget that, because that is something that can lead me back out. If I forget where I came from, and I don't ever want to leave you. I don't ever want to leave what I have been gifted in Alcoholics Anonymous and the life I've been given. I couldn't imagine my life without AA. I couldn't imagine my life without a God of my understanding. And I'm thankful to y'all for sharing your God with me until I could gather one of my own. I drank habitually. That obsession for alcohol came into my life that night and left me not for a while after I came here. I was thinking about the last time I had, planning the next time I would, doing it, reminiscing about it, whatever it was all consuming, and it just kept building and building and building. You know, I grew up, I would have told you, you know what, I wouldn't have learned to read if there wasn't graffiti in the hallway, because I spent most of my time in the hallway, because I was in trouble all the time. You know, I grew up before Ritalin. I grew up in the Catholic Church going to parochial school. I got paddling. I didn't get Ritalin, you know. And I was corrected regularly, and I needed to blame them for what they did and how they treated me badly and things like that, and did a lot of drinking at those types of things. But when I started drinking with regularity, it was all consuming. And I started having blackouts real early in my drinking. And I thought that was normal. I thought everybody that drank to a certain point would have a blackout. So it wasn't something to be afraid of. I kind of found it fun, to be honest with you. It was kind of like time travel, you know. You just kind of materialize in a new place with a new group of people, and you really just kind of be quiet and listen. Okay. And then you start conversing, and then you're gone, and poof, and then you come to another place. It was kind of a miraculous thing, but when you drink like that and have blackouts like that, you start to surround yourself with people that do that too, and you hope that the next morning you can kind of get the piecemeal of what actually happened. You know, somebody was in a brownout, not a blackout. Somebody was a grayout, and, you know, we just pieced the day and the night together. It was great, right? And so I kind of knew what I was doing. I had kind of keepers. I drank a lot to the point in which that I fell down, and I had keepers that would ask me, why do you do that? And I don't know. I just do. You know, that's the way I drink. I don't know how to not drink in excess. I would want to get there, that magical place of ease and comfort. But I'd always overshoot the mark. I don't know why, you know. I know now why. I couldn't control. The book describes it in, I believe, We Agnostics, and it gives a very apt description of alcoholism. It says, if when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, never applied to me, even when I came to you, or if when you start drinking, you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. I had little control over the amount I took from the time I was about 15 years old on. I didn't know that. I thought I drank to excess, to falling down, to blacking out, to passing out by choice. I really thought I was having a choice. And I had a lot of fun. I mean, I'd go to concerts and I'd do, you know, all kinds of crazy events. I played a lot of sports when I was in high school as well, and those were my two respites from my head. The things that went on between my ears were dominating me if I wasn't inebriated or on the athletic field. And that was that separate, that apart from, that disconnected feeling, that feeling of discontent. Restless, book describes, restless, irritable, and discontented. That's how I was perpetually, unless I was on a sports field or I was drinking. So what do? I throw myself into sports, alcoholically, and I threw myself into drinking, alcoholically. When I graduated high school, I was drinking 4 or 5 nights a week, 12-pack or more every time, drunk. And I loved it, and I didn't have any consequences. I got away with it. I was very proficient at lying. You know, my mother would always say things about my grandfather. How can you tell when a Mefford's lying? His lips are moving. And there was some truth in that with me, you know. I would lie when the truth would get me a better result. And if I could look you in the face and get you to nod, well, then it was truth. It was factual. It was real. Whether it was or not didn't matter. It became my reality. And that's the way I live my life. So when I graduated high school, I was 17. When I graduated, I was a little bit of a mama's boy. I was a little spoiled as the youngest. And so I wasn't really mature enough to go away to school. And I didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up. And so I went to the high school with ashtrays, the local junior college, to pursue a career playing baseball. I started playing baseball, and this was my first geographic. And it's interesting. I made a geographic change, not by moving across the country or from state to state. I didn't even change bedrooms. I just did a geographic from high school to junior college. And I reinvented myself. And that's the way I operated, is when I came into a new environment, I observed my surroundings, and I tried to be what it is that I thought that you thought that I should be in order to connect with you. And that's how I operated. I met my new best friends, Chris and Jeff. Chris and Jeff and I hit it off great. They drank like I drank. They liked to do things outside of drinking like I like to do things outside of drinking. We hatched a plan to develop a little distribution-oriented business. We established that business model on the college campus and in the local community, and it really took off well. I'm the starting catcher. I'm the captain of the field. We're having a great fall ball season. I come into the first day of spring semester, ready for spring training, getting ready to roll. We got college scouts coming in from D2 and D1 schools to maybe see if there's some talent at Waubonsie Community College outside of Chicago. And lo and behold, I got some possibilities going on. And Coach Randall calls Chris and Jeff and I to his office. And I thought, oh, that's not good. He's calling the three of us. He must know something. So what happens? The committee adjourns and starts hatching a plan to tell the story to get away with it. And if I can just do that, everything will be grand and wonderful. I sit down across from Coach Randall and he said, you can't play for me anymore. And I thought, well, you're making a huge mistake. I'm the captain of the field, the rudder of the ship. I am your starting catcher. Without me, you're going to be awful. You're going to be horrible. You have nobody to replace me with that will be the field general that you need to have the success that you're going to have this season. What I said was, okay, you know. I think big thoughts, but I'm really a coward. I mean, I can't stand up. I don't know how to do that. I'm a coward. I'm like, okay. And we talked for a while, and at the end of the conversation, he set some terms for me to continue to play. And he said, you still want to play? I said, absolutely. I'm playing this game since I was 7 years old. Blood, sweat, and tears. Believe I have a future. He affirmed those things. And he said, well, you got to do a few things. It was write some essays and do some research and things of that nature. And then he said the last thing, the fourth bullet. You need to arrange a meeting between he and my parents. And I thought, really, I hadn't spent much time in baseball. It didn't really matter that much. It really wasn't that important to me, really. Thanks, but no thanks, Coach. I'll quit. And that's what I do. When faced with controversial potential difficulties, I cut and run. That's what I do. I did that with my first love along about this same time. She questioned me about my drinking and driving. And I manufactured a way in order to depart myself from that relationship and make it her fault. Because don't question me about what I'm doing. I'm just fine. I'm not that bad yet. If I get that bad, I'll stop. You just don't understand. Why don't you get out of my kitchen? And that's the way I was operating. So that summer, I didn't have anything. No tether, no sports, no drive. And I just started drinking. Katie barred the door. You know, disrespecting my parents' home to no end, coming in at 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning, you know, those types of things, robbing them of their peace and serenity in their own home. getting ready and prepared to go away to the university in the fall, because I got an associate's degree, and my parents said they would pay the tuition to go to Northern Illinois University. And that fall, I departed Batavia, Illinois, and went out to DeKalb, and I started my journey as an independent adult at the university. My first semester was the most magnificent four-month engagement of drinking and carousing and cavorting that I had ever experienced in the entirety of my life. It was fantastic. I was having a ball. Met new friends, reinvented myself one more time, and just had an absolutely fantastic time. And then the report card came. And it was very apparent that I did everything but go to school, because my grade point average was 0.72. And my parents weren't real keen on that. They were paying the bill, and they said, we'll give you one more shot. And I thought, well, I better get back there and do something, because that was the best party my parents ever paid for, and I want to keep doing that. So I went back to school in that fall, that spring semester, and I was like, all right, I'm going to do something. I set my schedule a little later in the afternoon. I went to all my classes. I attended all my classes. And when I got done with class, I could test. And when I did test, I did well. I got a 3.5. I'm off probation. It's fantastic. Now I'm really going somewhere. Now I'm drinking all the time, but I'm on the track. I'm moving forward. Semester, 3.5, off probation. We're killing it. Problem was, is there was a break between the spring semester and the next fall of about 3 months. And I decided I was going to travel country and follow the Grateful Dead for a while, you know, and have a really good time doing that. Did, and was a ball, had a fun time. But the problem was, is it really just stopped all forward momentum with schooling. It just derailed it completely. And when I got back in the fall, I did the same thing I did the first semester. And at this point, I'm really at the point where I'm drinking the clock around. I'm not paying attention to anything but my drinking, and everything in my life revolves around drinking. If there's not drinking involved, I'm not doing it. I'm not going. I'm not participating. I don't want any part of it. I don't trust people that don't drink like I do. I'm surrounded by people that drink like I do. We wake up. We drink Budweiser for breakfast. It's the best breakfast meal there was. Barley and hops diet. That's the way it was. And we just rolled with it. And because I'm drinking the way that I'm drinking, I almost get out, you know, basically get back on probation, fail all this. And I said, okay, I'm going to. Bill talks about that fierce determination to win came back, and I thought, I'm going to do the same thing. I'm going to do another spring semester, get off probation, everything's great. And I signed up for a 12-hour class load so I could do that. About 6, maybe 7 weeks into the semester, I realized I made a mistake. 12 hours of school in college requires about 10 hours of classroom time. That's a little bit extensive in the commitment category for me. That really is hard to do when you're drinking like I'm drinking at this point, because I'm drinking to live and I'm living to drink. I'm not eating. I'm just drinking. My motto was continuously, it don't matter. That's the way I lived. People would say, you want to go to the bar? I'm like, sure. I thought you had a test or a class early tomorrow. It don't matter. Let's go. You know, I remember Huey and I, we hatched a plan Sundays to go to the bar. Because if we went to the bar on Sunday, any women that were at the bar, we knew on Sunday were there to find men. And we were going to be their men. So we went. The problem was, you know, I miscalculated, because when I walked across the threshold, I was in that bar every day, they handed me the frosty mug of Budweiser, and I started drinking. I forgot the objective. Until closing time. They call last call, and I get my two 16-ounce frosty mugs of Budweiser, and I'm sitting by the waitress stand at the end of the bar, and I start looking around. And I'm going to find her. Oh, you're the one. You're beautiful. I probably got puke on me. I mean, I was just a messy drinker. I threw up a lot. It was ugly. And I tell you this, if I knew then what I knew now, you'd have a different speaker, because I've listened to a lot of Al-Anon speakers in my years of sobriety, and they always talk about hearing the drunk say to them, I need you. If I just had those three words and approached that untreated Al-Anon, I would have been set. But I didn't know that. And they never went home with me. So I hatched another plan to try and, you know, keep my stellar academic status in good stead. And I went around to all my professors and told them I needed to withdraw because I needed to get a job. My girlfriend was pregnant. And I needed to get a job, pay for the baby. I didn't have a girlfriend. I just described you how I approach women. I mean, you don't get girlfriends like that. You know, it just didn't happen. And I quit school. And my parents are still footing the bill. And now they start having discussions about me when I'm not present. And then they have a command performance that I come back to their house. And I arrive at their house. They sit me down at the kitchen table and they go through the French doors into the living room where they're convened. And they start talking about, what are we going to do about him? What are we going to do about it? What are we going to do about that? You know, I'm no longer the loving youngest son, Douglas. I'm him, it, and that. They don't know what to do with me. And I don't get to participate in the conversation. That's the worst part. You know, if you just give me an opportunity to tell you my tale, it would be good. But they bought enough of that bull crap, and they don't want nothing to do with it. So they're now hatching plans. Now, my mother's oldest sister, Liz, or youngest sister, Liz, my mom's the oldest of six, used to come and stay with us for summers when she was in college and so on. She came to the rescue. Liz said to my mom, well, Doug could come to Nashville with Jim and I. And when presented with that, I thought, well, absolutely. That is a fantastic idea. If I get away from these losers at DeKalb, Northern Illinois University, that are dragging me down from my life's potential, that are really the weight that is weighing me down from doing what it is that I'm purposed to do in this world, I can get to Nashville and get a fresh start and just rock it on to the rest of my life. Be a rock star. It'll be great. So I did. I went down to Nashville. Now, I didn't realize they were setting the deck against me. My aunt was a certified drug and alcohol counselor. Not only that, they put me to work with my Uncle Jim at Nashville Wine and Spirits. I'm working at the liquor store. I got discounts. And so now I'm in this alcoholic assessment at my aunt's house. And I'm down there and I meet my new best friend, Stan. Stan and I are going to the bar after work for a little drink too. And we start drinking. And when I'm drinking, that's what I'm doing. It's an all-encompassing activity. And we drink a couple of beers and Stan says, I got to go. And I'm like, what do you mean you got to go? We're drinking. He says, I have drank. I only know that drank term coming to the next day because we're drinking. And he says, I got to go to band practice. He was a buddy musician and he left. And now I'm sitting in Nashville, Tennessee, drinking by myself, having taken the triggered dose, not knowing that I'm alcoholic and knowing that I can't stop. I don't know that. And now I'm alone. I don't have the lower companions that I point my finger at and say, I'm not that bad yet. But if I get that bad, I'll stop. Why don't you mind your own damn business? Now, when I honestly reflect upon those lower companions I'm describing, I was the lower companion. None of those guys were quitting school. None of those guys were going to the local VFW at 8:30 in the morning because they were shaking and drinking on wooden nickels like I was. They were attending college, university classes and getting degrees. Yeah, they drank heavy. I don't know if they were alcoholic or not. But I couldn't keep anything together. So I'm in Nashville, triggered dose, not liking being where I can't point my finger at somebody else. And so I hatched a plan to go back to Chicago for a visit. Well, his brother had a child, and I was going to go back and visit. Now, I had been in Nashville 6 weeks. 6 weeks. That's it. Couldn't handle it. I need to get back with those old buddies. And on the way back from Nashville, there's a little place called Noblesville, Indiana, Deer Creek Music Amphitheater, just north of Indianapolis. It's right on the route. Just so happened there was a 3-day Dead concert that weekend, and I'm going to meet up with those old friends and hang out for the week and have a good time. And then go meet my niece and everything's going to be great. Problem was, on the second night of that camping trip, I overindulged in a vast number of substances, including a tremendous volume of alcohol. I had a white light near-death experience. I don't know how long I was dead, but it was a long enough time that it hurt like hell when I rejoined this world. And I came out of that situation in a paranoid, delusional, psychotic state. And I didn't know it. And that manifested in me that the FBI, the ATF, the DEA, and all those federal bureaus were after me. They wanted to know what I knew, who I'd been doing it with, how long I'd been doing it. And I was like, this is not good. And so I'm driving back to Chicago thinking there's a pattern of traffic following me. I mean, this is a really big delusion. I think my alcoholic ego fed that delusion for sure. And my mind was, I have to turn myself in to become an undercover agent. That's what they want. And if I don't do that, they're going to throw me in jail. And I'm not fit for jail. I can't do jail. I mean, no, I can't do jail. And so 6 days, I walk around with my siblings and I talk about, they're listening, they're watching, they're listening. Well, who? Those guys, the red license plates. They can hear us. And I mean, I'm Looney Tunes, literally crazy, trying everything I can to relieve paranoia. I'm not talking paranoia like peeking through the blinds. I'm talking paranoia. Go to a football game with 75,000 people in the stands and you think they're talking about you in the huddle. That kind of paranoia. I mean, It was eating me alive. And I'm six, seven days into this delusion. I now have to return to Nashville to go back to work. And my older brother, who was 6.5 years sober at the time, he knows something's wrong. But he knows he can't do anything for me, so he does what we do. He turns up the pressure. You got to go. And I'm postponing and evading, shucking and jiving, and saying, I'll just take a nap and I'll drive straight into work and this and that. And no, you got to go. And I'm just like, man, if I go, I'm going to prison. And the honor among thieves of my life, I can't turn myself into a narc. There's no other options here. This is terrible. And finally, I looked at him at his last ditch effort. I said, Rob, I'm an alcoholic and I don't know what to do about it. And he said, you just took the first step. Now, what I can tell you is I didn't take the first step, because the first step is contained on page 30 in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And what it says, you had to fully concede your innermost selves that you were alcoholic. This is the first step in recovery. What I did was utter some words that set up a series of events that led me to you. The next morning, my life was literally in the balance. I had a plan on how I was going to kill myself, because I couldn't turn myself in and I wasn't going to prison. And my mom was dialing the phone and she'd call AA, and AA would answer, and I would say, I need a meeting and I need a meeting now. And they said, you can go over here. That's too far. You can go over here then, and that's too long. Don't you know who I am? I'm turning myself in. I mean, this is important stuff. And AA's hanging up on me. I mean, probably saved my life, quite frankly, because y'all couldn't help me, no doubt. The phone call that was answered was at Mercy Center Hospital Addictions Treatment Program in North Aurora, Illinois. And they said, we'll take him right now. And I got in the back of my parents' car and we drove down there and I did an intake interview at the Addictions Treatment Program. And they interviewed me with my mom on my left and my dad on my right. And I told them everything I'd been doing, for how long I've been doing it, how much I've been doing it, and all of the things. Because I thought I was giving my resume, because I'm turning myself in to become an undercover agent. I really wish they didn't know all that they knew at that point, because it really disturbed them. I got sober after that. We'll get into that. But I was 6 months into sobriety, working a third shift job, stable, going to meetings every day, doing all the things. And when I was on the weekends, not on the third shift, I'd go to a clubhouse. And I'd stay after, drink coffee, and play pool and hang out. We'd go to Denny's all night, 24-hour place, whatever. And I'd walk in the house about 3 o'clock, and my dad would be awake on the couch, invariably every Friday and Saturday night. I'd be like, what are you doing up? You know, I just woke up. I was probably 10 years sober before I really realized the reason he was awake is because he didn't know if I was going to come home sober or not. He heard that story when I went into that treatment program. He knows what I'm capable of doing to myself, and he needs to verify that I'm not doing that when I come back into his house. The most selfish statement any alcoholic can make is, I'm only hurting myself. The most selfish statement we can make is, I'm only hurting myself. I robbed my parents of a tremendous amount of peace and serenity. Hours I will never be able to return to them. I went into the treatment program. They realized that I needed to be in the 2 West, the locked nut hut over there. I didn't belong with y'all. So they sent me in there, and they sent me to occupational therapy. I sewed a wallet, you know, crafted an ashtray, walked up and down the hall with my nice padded slippers. I was so bad they wouldn't let me go outside by myself to smoke. And I was a smoker, and I literally liked to smoke, and I needed to smoke. We only got to smoke once an hour. I'm in the nut hut. There's about 15 of us in there, and all of us smoke. And they open this little smoking room for 10 minutes once an hour. I mean, you put 15 crazy people in a room that's about 10 by 10 and say, smoke for 10 minutes, I'm surprised I don't have cancer. I mean, really. Because it was, I mean, those of you that have seen Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Spicoli's bus had nothing on this room, because we come rolling out of there, there's smoke going, just billowing out. I don't know why we're only restricted to that room, because we polluted the whole wing. 15 people smoke about 6 cigarettes in 10 minutes, by the way. It's crazy. I'm sitting in this hospital and I'm still reading. I'm reading the 12 and 12. I read the 12 and 12 cover to cover, thinking it is an undercover manual. It's an instruction manual. Bill talks multiple times in that book about, you know, then came the acid test. I can pass that. I can pass that. I believe my alcoholism fed the delusion that I lived in, because my belief was that I could become an undercover agent and continue to drink, continue to do other things, lead an exciting life, get paid for it, and have no risk of ever getting caught or in trouble. I mean, hell, that sounds like a great deal to me at that point. And on the 15th day of being in that psychotic state in the hospital, 23 days into the psychosis, I'm sitting in a room with a counselor named Jerry, and Jerry says to me, I say, when are y'all going to just tell me the truth? We all know why I'm here. I know I'm here. You know why I'm here. Why don't we just get on with it and move on with this training process so we can, you know, really get into this? He said, here's the deal, Doug. There's you, and there's all of us professionals in this room. And on that table in the middle of the room, there's a cat. And all the professionals tell you it's a cat. And when we say to you, what is it? You say it's a dog. That's the truth of what's going on here. You do not see the reality of what's going on. And I came back. I don't consider myself special. I consider myself very fortunate and lucky. Because that happened on a Wednesday. The following Monday, there was a court date set to send me to the state institution and have me certified and become a ward of the state. I don't know why I'm here. All I know is I'm lucky because there's a lot of people that don't come out of that state. And I was very close to that. I had one last little debauch that weekend, which led me to failing a urinalysis, and they knew that I was lying, and I was lying because I wanted to get away with it. It was one last time. August the 16th, the second day of my sobriety, a man from Alcoholics Anonymous came to the treatment center. His name was Daryl M. He was 8.5 years sober. He'd been in that treatment center 8.5 years prior, and he talked about what he was thinking, feeling, and doing when he sat in the chairs that I was sitting in that night. And something happened. My mother used to describe it. She said, I watched that man save your life. I watched it happen. And what I did was I identified. His alcoholism touched my alcoholism and allowed me to identify. And I'm such a believer in the singleness of purpose that affords alcoholics the opportunity to identify with each other. Because it's only there, as the book describes, I think, in one of our pieces of literature says, you know, recovery begins when one alcoholic shares with another experience, strength, and hope. The language of the heart. And his alcoholism touched mine, and I got just a smidgen of hope because what I had happen was, how can you know that? You don't seem to be in that situation anymore. How can you know that if you hadn't been there? I believe that you've been where I am, but you're not there anymore. Maybe, just maybe, I don't have to stay here. Hope. I thought about the lie that I had to tell to get away with the one last time all night that night. And at about 5:15, I physically sat up in my bed. I threw my hands up and I said, God, please help me. I don't want to live like this anymore. I didn't say, God, please help me not to drink. I don't know if inherently I knew that I didn't have a drinking problem. And if you suffer from alcoholism like I suffer from alcoholism, you don't and never have had a drinking problem either. Because alcoholism for me really is embodied in the fact that alcohol is a solution that eases the pain of living. It's not a drinking problem. It creates problems for sure. But my alcoholism, drinking is just a symptom. I didn't want to live like that anymore. And I went to the treatment center and I told the truth for the first time in forever. And it felt wonderful. And it lit my fire. I became a model treatment patient. I went to my first AA meeting at 219 East Galena Avenue in Aurora, Illinois. It was an old converted union hall. And I walked down the half stairs into this long room with a bunch of 6-foot tables side by side and about 85 chairs around them and a bunch of people. And that guy that was at the treatment center on Tuesday was the head of the table. I thought, well, he's the boss of AA. I'm going to talk to him. And I walked up to him. They're telling me to get a sponsor. And I walked up to him and said, will you be my sponsor? And he said, let's talk after the meeting. And I sat in that meeting, 22 years old, and cried like ugly cried. I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm 22. My life's over. These old people, what am I doing here? I mean, snot bubbles, kind of stuff, ugly crying the whole meeting. Because it's like, God, I'm in AA. I'm never going to drink again. I mean, I knew what y'all were talking about. I heard what they were saying. Never drinking. And Daryl and I talked after the meeting. It was probably to this day still one of the most important conversations I've ever had in the entirety of my life, because what he did was establish the terms of accountability for me to work with him. Told me how I would dress, how I would act, what I would say, where I would go, when I would go, how I'd behave. Told me what AA was and what AA was not, what a sponsor was and what a sponsor was not. At the end of the conversation, as we engaged, he said, I have to ask you one more question. Are you willing to go to any length for victory over alcohol? And for lack of a better answer, I said, yes. And he said, okay, well, what are you doing tomorrow? I said, well, I'm off treatment, so I'm probably going to sleep in. I'll probably get up. I'm going to eat a little breakfast. I'll probably watch some TV on the couch, you know, relax and refresh and rejuvenate. And he said, I don't think so. He said, you will wake up at 5:30 in the morning. You will report to Cool Acres Park. And you will ask Rick what you can do for the annual Fox Valley Fellowship's summer pig roast picnic. I didn't know you could change sponsors. I didn't know you could say no. And I did what that man asked me to do the next morning. I know today why I was given the gift of desperation. And I didn't want to keep doing what I'd been doing, and I saw that he wasn't doing what he was doing, so I was willing to trust him enough to do what he asked me to do. And he gave me a wonderful, precious lifetime gift the next day. Because what I did was go report in and ask what I could do, and I started to serve you before I knew what service was. And I boiled corn and I melted butter and I stood at a serving line at about 11 o'clock that morning. And I dunked an ear of corn in a vat of butter and I put it on plates as people came by. And John and Chico and Janet and Kelly and Karen and Bob and Bill and Daryl and Denny said, Doug, God, they remembered my name. It's good to see you. I believed them. Keep coming back. And I wanted to. See, and that precious gift was serving you, and I believe if we can arm the newcomers with activity to be with us, it's beneficial to them. Because it's through that serve of others, the barrier of self-centered isolation that alcoholism constructs around me lowers just enough that the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and the gift of God's grace can be received. I have to be able to receive it. We can give it all we want, but Alcoholics Anonymous is not for people to be given to. You have to come and take it. I can want for you to be sober with every fiber of my being and do everything in my power to give you every opportunity, experience, and benefit that Alcoholics Anonymous has to offer. But if you don't take it, you won't get it. That's the sad fact. And why desperation is such a key element, because desperation begets willingness. Willingness begets action. Action begets results. Thankfully, I was given that desperation to start. Daryl and I started doing the deal, working the steps out of the book. He gave me a good basis of recovery in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and I worked through the steps. And in working through the steps, I came to understand who I was and more about me and the alcoholism and its effect on me and how I needed this God of my understanding to intervene in my life because I couldn't of my own choice change my behavior. I always lowered the bar to meet my behavior. I never raised my behavior to the bar. I don't know about anybody, you know, draw the line in the sand. When I get the line, I'll walk right through it and just draw another one. You know, I mean, that's just the way I operate. You know, the high cost of low living didn't matter. I'm just going to keep doing it. But Daryl raised the bar and he held the bar and he had me behave in a way that was equivalent to the bar. Stop lowering the bar. Stop lowering the standard. Change your behavior through these prescribed actions. And that's what I did. And I went around and I started making amends. And the amends that I made with my family were all very prevalent and very important. They were the people most close to me. My sister and I were like soulmates when I was in high school. She was in college. And by the end of my drinking the last couple of years, she said, I don't like you when you're like that. And that was inebriated. So I just disengaged from this female in my life that was like a soulmate. We were really that close. I just disengaged. Fast forward, I get sober and I end up driving. I flew from Chicago to Houston. She lived in Houston. And I spent the weekend to make direct amends with her. And we had a long conversation and a good cry and all of those things. Fast forward another couple of years and she asked me to be the godfather of her firstborn child. How do you go from I don't like you when you're like that to would you be a spiritual influence in my daughter's life? Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the only vehicle I know that does that transformation, that allows people to reconstruct a life worth living. It was an amazing thing. I talked to her for about 30 minutes on my birthday on the way down here this afternoon, and we had a great laugh. She's a great kid. I love her to death. I made amends with my older brother. My next oldest brother had a bunch of difficulties with. He asked me to be the best man in his wedding. My oldest brother asked me to be, you know, the goddaughter of his third child. My parents said, it's nice to have our son back, because I lived with them for the first 2 years I was sober. It's nice to have our son back. I'm only hurting myself. I'm not hurting anybody but me. I'm not that bad yet, but when I get that bad, I'll stop. Why don't you just mind your own damn business and leave me alone? I'm rocking along and things are going well. I'm going to speed this along. I'm 2 years sober. I'm dating a girl down in Dallas, Texas. And I decide I'm going to move down there and see how that's going to go. Now, 2 years, 2 months, and 2 weeks sober. I was an expert. Absolute aficionado on all things Alcoholics Anonymous. I flatly arrived in Dallas-Fort Worth and promptly got an absolute idiot for a sponsor. He didn't hold me accountable. He didn't lead by example. He didn't hold the bar. He just kind of bought off on my BS. He didn't tell me what to do. He just said, you know, yeah, that's all right. Just keep trying. Just keep doing. Just keep going. And I'm just showing up to meetings, leaving right after, not engaging. 10 months into that, I throw away the relationship. I almost lose my job, and I'm headed towards picking up a drink. And I became willing to be willing one more time and started going early and staying late. And that idiot that I'm describing as a sponsor is the guy that's talking to you right now. I believe one of the isms of alcohol ISM is I sponsor myself. And if that applies to you, I'm just going to tell you, you got an idiot for a sponsor. And if you don't like that, find somebody you trust and talk to them about it. Because the guy that looks me in the mirror can't be objective about me. Can't give me good, solid direction. Can't be an outside observer that cares more about me than he does my feelings. He'd give me objective input on the decisions, choices, and actions that I'm making and taking. That's what a sponsor is effective at doing, is becoming emotionally unaffected by my choices and actions to give me the guidance and direction I need to make better, more principled, elevated standard decisions. And I found this guy, 6'5", about 250, a guy named Stuart, and I started running around going to meetings with him, and we were kicking rocks out on a parking lot. And I said, Stuart, I've been thinking about asking you to sponsor me. And he just turned on his heel. He's the nicest guy right up until this point. And he looked down at me, he said, thinking about it. Thinking about it, huh? Is there a question you'd like to ask me? Would you be my sponsor? He said, it'd be an honor and a privilege, but we have to have a conversation. And in that conversation, he set the terms. And he sealed the deal by asking me the question, are you willing to go to any length for victory over alcohol? And I knew I was home. And I started doing the deal in Dallas-Fort Worth and spent 17 and a half years there. And Stuart and I started working through steps. I took a commitment as a corrections terror in District 55. And then I also ended up in Northeast Texas area doing a bunch of area service, convention chair, corrections facility, all of these different things. And spent 10 years going to the area meetings on a quarterly basis. And really, it enhanced my sobriety. That three legacy recovery was critically important between district meetings and area meetings. And general service was a way in which that I did it. I also carried a meeting into a jail on a weekly basis for many, many years. And I loved that engagement and commitment. And that's where I really learned commitment. I remember when I was doing the jail meeting, I went in there. It was Christmas night, the 25th of December. And I showed up and they're like, what are you doing here? It's Christmas. I said, it's Wednesday. But it's Christmas. I said, it's Wednesday. I come here every Wednesday. I was trained to come here every Wednesday. When I say I'm going to do something, I will do it. I could never do that when I was drinking. I was a better deal guy all the way around. I mean, you want to do this? Well, yeah, maybe. Yeah, I'll think about that. And if it was the best deal at the end of the day, I would do that. But if a better deal came along, I'm going that way. I mean, that's just the way I operate. And here in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've learned commitment, and the consistency of commitment is critically important. My wife and I went through some difficulties as a result of me getting a resentment at God. I don't have time to get into that, but we ended up in a 6-month separation just after my daughter Rachel was born. And I can tell you this, I did a lot of work in 6 and 7, the true surrender steps, to get to the place in which there is a humble, defined reliance on God to remove from me the crap that I'm still living with in sobriety. See, I could die stark raving sober, no ifs, ands, or buts about it. If I'm not willing to rely on this power and actually humbly offer myself to Him, warts and all, to take me where He would have me be, I can die stark raving sober in here. It's all about what God does, because I can't, of my own accord, do it differently. And I learned that 10 years sober, a bitter pill of truth, a lot of bitter pills of truth I had to swallow about myself. And you know, that daughter of mine is 19 years old, and she's why I got to leave tomorrow. When she was 20 months old, I have a committed meeting schedule. It's a consistent committed meeting schedule. When she was 20 months old on Thursday, my wife is also sober. She and I started dating in Alcoholics Anonymous. We were given direction on how to do that. We successfully did it. We ultimately got married. If we make it to April next year, it'll be 25 years. Can't believe that. But regardless, we both went to meetings on Thursdays. I went to meeting on Tuesday. She went to meeting on Monday. We had family night Wednesday. So it was a consistency. When my daughter was 22 months old, Kelly, the next door neighbor, came over to babysit. My wife would say to Rachel, Kelly home tomorrow. Kelly's here to babysit. And her response was, Daddy home tomorrow. The consistency of committed participation allowed her to trust when and where I would be. Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't have to compete with my family. Am I engaged when I'm present? Or do I sit with my feet up and relax? Or do I engage like I'm at the prepaid convention and I'm around a bunch of fellow alcoholics that charge and fire me up when I'm at home? And I try to engage with my family in that way. I've got a stepson who's 36. He's in prison. It's his third stint in prison. He's one of us. He gave us a granddaughter when we were, when I was younger than I thought I would be as a grandfather, I can assure you. My wife's a little older than I am. I didn't realize in my 30s I would be sleeping with a grandma. But that's the way it happened. Needless to say, they drank and left the baby in the bed. We had to take her, and we took her for a period of time and, have been through the ringer with a child. And that's another reason I know that just saying I'm only hurting myself is such a fallacy. Because I'm a recovering alcoholic, and at 10, 11 years of sobriety, I get a knock on the door, and it's the police, and it's my son's in prison. He's in jail. And they want to search the house because they got him with a tent to distribute. Not a fun process. And then he gets out and he goes to treatment. He comes back in and he starts smoking methamphetamine 6 feet away from my daughter's bed. And then he's out on the street and he's living in a tent because he's not allowed to cross the threshold of our house because he's stealing from us. And we're walking around in Alcoholics Anonymous doing the best we can with what we got, hoping for the best for him and planning a funeral because we're afraid he's going to die. And I'd stand behind one of these podiums and I'd tell a story and somebody would come up to me after the meeting in all good meaning, say your son's going to be okay and tell me a story about theirs. And I always respond with, and I still to this day believe this with every fiber of my being, my son Aaron is going to be okay. I just don't know if it's ever going to be on this earth. And that's a sad reality of alcoholism and drug addiction. It kills people. It kills a lot of people. And I don't ever want to forget that. As fun as it is, as engaging as it is, as fulfilling as it is, I don't ever want to get away from the deadly nature of alcoholism. Because if I forget that, I'm likely going to be one of those candidates that's 6 feet under. I moved to Georgia in 2013. I'm going to tell a couple of stories and wrap this up. I didn't want to move to Atlanta. I had no interest in living in Atlanta. I loved Dallas-Fort Worth. I met Mary and my wife there, bought my first house there. My daughter was born there, but it seemed the next indicator right action. And so in January of 2013, I moved to Atlanta. Now, God knows what He knows long before it happens, in my estimation. And there was a period of time that I didn't always know that. Today, it's absolutely clear and apparent to me. And this story is one of God putting the dominoes in play long before they fall. I was standing outside the San Antonio International Convention smoking a cigarette, and a little Indian man comes walking up and says, "Hello, my name's Lawrence, Lalu. Nice to meet you." We start talking. And Lalu was a recovering member of Alcoholics Anonymous from Middle Eastern India. And he said, as we departed after about 15 minutes of conversation, "If you ever come to India, I would love to host you at my coffee plantation." And I thought, okay, great. Not going to happen. India is not on my bucket list, not on my to-do destination landscape. Great. Lolly would call every couple of months. We'd talk. We stayed in contact. Fast forward, I get laid off. I end up having to go to Atlanta. When I went to Atlanta, I interviewed for a job in the tech space. And the lady that was to hire me says, "If we hire you, would you be willing to travel to India to our development office?" Matter of fact, I would. I negotiate the terms, I accept the offer, and it's Friday night. I'm getting ready to depart Dallas-Fort Worth and head to Atlanta on Saturday morning. It's 9 o'clock at night. I'm trying feverishly over the last 3 weeks to find Lalu's number. I can't find it. He always calls the house phone. I'm never going to connect with him because we're going to sell the house. We're not going to have the home phone. We're never going to connect. I'm going to go to India and not be able to meet up with him. This is awful and god-awful and terrible. And 9:30, the phone rings. Lalu. And we connect. I travel to Bangalore, India. I have dinner with he and his wife at a hotel. It was a 3-day weekend. In the course of a 3-week trip, I got on a government bus at the Majestic bus station in Bangalore. from 11 o'clock at night till 6:30 in the morning and traveled to a place called Chikmangul. It's on the southwestern part of the peninsula of India. And a little foreman from his plantation picked me up in a jeep and drove me up over the mountain around the horseshoe and up to his plantation. And for 72 hours, I sat in a quiet place without television or cell signal and had a conversation about Alcoholics Anonymous with another member on an entirely different continent. We went up to the top of the mountain on the second night to get cell phone signal so he could call his wife. He finished the call when the back door of the jeep opened up, and it startled me, and two little gentlemen got in the back of the jeep. They were neighboring plantation boys, 90 days sober each. And we had a meeting about an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting by cell phone light. And Lalu translated from Hindi to English and English to Hindi. Don't tell me that God doesn't know where he's got for you to go. He'll set the terms and circumstances to allow you to experience such magical, magical moments. But the requirement is that I go to him with my hands open, palms up, and say, "What would you have me do?" And it doesn't matter whether I want to. My want to does not matter to the God of my understanding. My willingness and my action is what counts. My mom went to Al-Anon when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and we developed a great relationship. When I moved to Texas, it started to drift, and then they moved and retired to Arkansas, and I started seeing her more. And she was engaged in Al-Anon on a committed basis. I carry one of her Al-Anon medallions, and I remember she needed to have a heart catheterization. She did, and they had some blockage, and they said, "We need you to go under the knife. We're going to have to do bypass, or you're at risk of having a major event." And she knew she had some risk, and she decided that it was worth it to go through the surgery. I lost my mom on the hospital table, on the surgical table. But that's not the story. The story is, how does God prepare you to deal with the things that he puts in your path? Not a second before could I have dealt with that tragic circumstance, but at the moment I was given what I need. I'm an alcoholic of the nature that when things happen around me, my first instinctual thought is, how's that going to affect me? What impact is that going to have on my comfort level? I'm standing in the hospital room. They call us out of the waiting room into a locked room, and the head nurse comes up and says, "We're having some difficulty." Now, I'm with my father, who's married to my mother at 53 years at the time, and my older sister, who talks to my mother on a daily basis. They're best friends. And I know they are much closer on a day-to-day basis with my mother than I, but I am very in-depth close with my mother. I know that we're going to lose her on the table based on what's going on. I step out of the room and I call my sponsor and I said, "Stuart, I'm about to lose my mom in this surgery." And his response was, "You go be of service to your father and your sister, and we will be of service to you." I walked back in that room and the surgeon came in and said her aorta just disintegrated in my hand, and I watched my dad and my sister break plumb in half. And I didn't have the thought, on a day that was probably most impactful, the loss of my mother, how is this going to affect me? I was given the grace of God's power to stand in the gap for my father and my sister and help them process that information and walk into the pre-surgery suite to my mother's lifeless body and hold their hands and say a prayer over her lifeless body. I'm not capable of that. Only God is capable of that. I love Alcoholics Anonymous with every fiber of my being. I love the life it has given me. I love the benefits and the rewards, and I never want to look or take for granted that gift. And I darn sure don't ever want to let the gifts of sobriety take me away from that which gave them to me. So when Fran called, I said yes, because I didn't have anything on my calendar, and that's the way I was raised. Commitments to Alcoholics Anonymous and saying yes has afforded me a life that I didn't think I was capable of having. I damn sure didn't think I wanted, because I had made a concession at 17 years old. Give me a shanty roof over my head, enough booze in my body, and I'll be okay. God, how would I have sold myself short? How would I have sold myself short? Over the last 7 weeks, we've been dealing with some stuff with my dad. He got COVID. He ended up in the hospital. He ended up in a coma state. He came out of that and went to rehab, fell down, and so on. It's been a tough journey, but the reality is it's not that tough, because that's just life. Troubles and difficulties, trials and tribulations, joys and sorrows, that's what's going to happen. Alcoholics Anonymous and the God of my understanding arm me with the ability to live life on life's terms, to accept what comes to the best of my ability, The book describes when trouble comes, cheerfully capitalize it as an opportunity for him to demonstrate his omnipotence. If anybody does that cheerfully, please come tell me about how they do that after the meeting. Capitalize, yes. Cheerfully, not so much. Kicking and screaming sometimes, and that's okay. God meets me where I am. Life's really good. And if your life isn't as good as maybe what you've seen or experienced or heard from people, know there's going to be ups and downs, peaks and valleys, but do what the book describes to be done. When it says pray, pray. When it says, you know, ask, ask. When it says talk, talk. Do the things that the book describes, and God will meet you right where you are. And for me, the gift of sponsorship, both in being sponsored and being afforded the opportunity to have a front row seat to watch lives change, is the most miraculous high I have ever experienced. To watch the lights come on, to watch a life transformed, is such a bigger high than any drug or alcohol ever gave me. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. I can tell you this, I don't always know what God's will is, I don't always know what God's will isn't. But I believe the God of my understanding is pleased when I make Him my first choice rather than my last resort. Thank you.